chaotic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts. They'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics. Brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Hi, this is the second half of my interview with Robert Sherman. To hear the first half, well, it's not rocket science. Go and listen to the previous episode. We were sort of touching upon your sort of early-ish writing career, stage. Was Doctor Who the first thing you wrote that wasn't for the stage, for Big
No.
Or did you write a lot for? You wrote a lot of Radio 4, didn't you?
I did. I mean, that's how I got involved in, because I was doing a fair amount of Radio 4, and that's probably trying to work out all the timings. What happened was that at the very beginning of Big Finish, Nick Pegg and Barnaby Edwards, who went on to play Daleks, I've been at university with them.
In your episode, bizarrely, who could have?
Well, Barnaby, yeah.
He
was my darling. But he'd also been a friend at university. And Nick Pegg had directed me in Hamlet at the theatre I one day became resident writer at, the Northcote in Exeter. And I was terrible. And yet he'd forgiven me and didn't mind. I mean, I was, as I say, a really terrible actor.
Were you Hamlet?
No. I was Horatio. But again, this is a time when I was stammering and I was gabbling and my L's and my R's are very weak. And for some reason, I got through the net. I gave a very good audition because I used to audition quite well. And he recognised me. I mean, I went into the audition. The first thing that Nick said to me was he recognised me from my King's Demons review I wrote when I was 13 for a fanzine called Christopher, in which I criticised the entire story because I misheard the dialogue. Which, you know, does sort of haunt you. So Nick got involved when Big Finish started. He was an early writer and director, and he told Gary Russell that he knew someone who was a big Doctor Who fan, who was also a writer who did radio. And Gary was interested, and he contacted me. And it was very early days. It was, I think I bought the first 2 or 3 already, and then immediately found I was in meetings to do another one, and I was asked whether I would come up with an idea for Tom Baker, and I said sure, and I gave them an idea, and they said we like that. Tom has very openly at a convention thrown your idea and a couple of others into the bin, but would you make it Cohen Baker? Oh, and while you're at it, could you put in a talking penguin? So I wrote an audio called The Holy Terror, and I had a great time with it. It was such fun. It's quite a violent comedy. But again, because I'm a comedy writer, I just wanted to try and get that synthesis of writing my own stuff with it being Doctor Who, where everybody ends up brutally killed, like Horror Fang Rock. And having done it, I thought, yeah, I really enjoyed that. And it's a bit overwritten. I remember in the recording, it's quite self-indulgent, but it's good fun. And I fully believed as I was doing it that it would be my one and only Doctor Who story ever. And I was very happy with that. It wasn't the one I would probably... It's not, you know, had I been told at the very beginning, would you write a Doctor Who story, one story in your life, and put a walking, talking penguin in it, it wouldn't have been my immediate go-to idea. But I also felt very proud of it. I think it's, you know, decent. And at the recording, which was good fun, I was asked by Gary whether I would do another one. That became The Chimes of Midnight, and that had to be written very, very quickly. So I suddenly found myself, I was still writing theatre, I was still writing radio, and alongside it, I was suddenly writing non-stop about half a dozen Doctor Who stories. So as I was writing one, I was starting another one because there was an immediate commission. And that went on into the 40th anniversary, so up until 2003. So I was
Wonderful.
having a great time. So for about 2 years, maybe 2.5 years, it was non-stop Doctor Who. And I decided it became very obvious to me. And it was very gratifying because people seemed to like them. And it was really wonderful. I mean, they would win things like Doctor Who magazine season polls, which I know sounds a bit silly, but obviously are very, very proud of. And you'd go on to Outpost Gallifrey, which was the Gallifrey base as was then, and people liked them. They wouldn't always buy it. I mean, Holy Terror didn't really sell because it had Frobisher in, but people liked it if they did hear it. And I felt
I love
it was
Frobisher
becoming,
for that way because
I
I'm
do.
a comic book guy, I guess. So
Sure.
that era,
Yeah.
and we work with John Ridgway now, so
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean,
that era
Frobisher
of
is a great.
Colin Baker and Frobisher is more that era of Doctor Who to me
I
than
think
the
it was.
TV
I
version.
think it was a good excuse, really. It was a good excuse for people who were buying them every month. When you advertise one as being a sidestep, which is what they did, which I think was a mistake, to say, oh, that's one we don't have to get because it's actually even saying as we go into it, it's not canon. And I think you get obsessed by the idea. If you're having to spend, so they were still about £14 even then a month, I think. So if you're buying them, you're thinking, oh, this is 20 plus years ago. Oh, this month I can take off. You just say, I don't have to buy the Holy Terror. So, but it was nice because I was doing all these things about Jubilee and Scherzo, and I realised that all my Doctor Who stories were the same, which was basically they're all Castrovalva, my own first Doctor Who story. They're all basically going to a sort of fictitious place and walking around in circles because that's what I quite like. I don't know why. The Doctor Who stories I really love, from the new series, things like Heaven Sent. Heaven Sent is so much obviously geared to what I would like. I like The Mind Robber. I like those sorts of stories. And I realised that I should probably get out of Doctor Who before everyone noticed. So I very deliberately said, I'm going to finish this now with Deadline. That was going to be a sort of a very happy goodbye. And then I got the call from Russell T. Davies about 2, 3 months later, so I was back in Doctor Who again, but that wasn't something I expected at
No.
all. So I sort of felt that I always felt with Doctor Who I was spinning plates, and I was waiting for people to notice that I was dropping all of the crockery. But I sort of got away with it. I think that all the audios I did for Big Finish, they're actually still quite popular.
Oh,
It makes me feel very, very,
they're
makes me
still,
very happy that people still like
yeah,
it.
they're still selling. I mean, they're,
I mean, and it's nice because there was now so many of them, and there were so many far more ambitious Doctor Who stories than the ones that I did, and far better written. And I think the quality of writers now, people would like John Dorney and Matt Finn and Lisa McMullen. And I mean, I think that they're far more sophisticated than what I was doing, and they're far more experienced. But nevertheless, people remember those early ones, partly because there weren't that many of them. We were only doing one a month. So you had a 4 week window where you genuinely felt that the show was dead anyway. You felt that this was the one Doctor Who story that everyone might listen to for 1 month. Of course, there is so much out there that you can. I know full well if I wrote The Chimes of Midnight right now, it wouldn't get a fraction of the response that it got back in 2002. But that's just the nature of it. I feel incredibly grateful for it, and it's such a happy time of my life, really. And I feel really proud of what we were doing back then, which is, so that collective thing of those first 50 audios, I sort of felt I was part of a big family. We were all bouncing off each other and sort of inspiring each other. I mean, that's, I know we're sort of moving up to it. I mean the choice I made was a Big Finish audio, which in some ways for me represents, it's not by me, but it also represents, I think, that time when we were all being really ambitious and imaginative and playful.
Yeah. So Jacqueline
And
Rayner's
again,
Doctor Who
we
and the
could do that
Pirates.
because we genuinely thought there was not a chance to show. Yeah, Doctor
Yeah.
Who and the Pirates, which is the one where there's a cliffhanger. The cliffhanger is based around the idea we're going to have to hear Colin Baker sing some Gilbert and Sullivan. I mean, it's very funny. It's also very, very sad when you actually realize what the story's really about. It's terribly touching. And it's so inventive. I mean, only I think this is the 40th monthly adventure. And we're already bending the format. And the reason that Pirates is there is because there is a culture at the time in Big Finish where we're all kind of pushing each other. I'm not saying that, I mean, Jack doing the Pirates will have inspired people to have done more playful things after that. And I remember when I first heard the Pirates and just feeling not jealous of it, because you don't feel jealous. I felt, oh, I wish I'd done that, but also at the same time, almost giggling with the fact that Jack had done it. It was the fact that, you know, that everybody was just being so inventive, and that we were all, like, there was a core team of writers. We were all about say, doing our third or fourth audio. I think Pirates might be Jack's second, actually. She'd have Mary in Conspiracy, didn't she? So it was the sense in which we were all kind of pushing ourselves further. And I just loved it. I found that sort of atmosphere where we said, well, Doctor Who is ours now. And no one from the BBC cares, and no one's going to watch what we do. And I certainly, the audios I wrote, I wouldn't have thought they would be appropriate for the Doctor Who audience now. But we could do an audio like Jubilee, where I basically just spend time cutting off dwarves' legs for fun. Because you can. Because the audience isn't the audience that the TV show's wanting. And Pirates is just this wonderful, good-hearted, warm, very funny, very silly, and very serious story. And I just think it's one of the best things Big Finish have done. And it for me, it represents those first years of Big Finish and the joy and the pride I take in being part of that.
Yeah, and Colin Baker can certainly sing, can't he? Based on this anyway.
Although you mustn't tell him that, because he might actually do it. I'm extremely fond of Colin. He's a good mate. And you don't want to get him sick if you can help it.
I've never actually heard him sing in real life, no. But
I'm not sure I ever have, actually. But I'm also aware that I would give him no encouragement.
He does seem like somebody who could give a good Gilbert and Sullivan.
I've got this weird photo of Colin in my kitchen, taken at the time when I was probably a teenager, because I didn't know, obviously, Colin, because I'm living in a house that is owned by my wife, who bought the house with Katie Manning back in the late 70s. So, because my wife's older than I am. And so they would have parties, and Colin Baker, before he did Doctor Who, I've got a picture of him in my kitchen upstairs, looking incredibly sexy, I've got to say. He's a very, very attractive man. He still is, actually, bless him. He has such charisma to him. And here he is on the seat that I go and sit on whenever I get on my shoes before going off for a hike. There he is in full, you know, bloom upstairs. It makes me smile. Colin Baker's been in my house.
Free on DVD with issue 6 of Warp Warp.
I stopped the car at last and let the fog close in around
me. Brand new animation by Mel.
I knew I was somewhere on Barnes Common, and I had a suspicious idea it was the most deserted part as well.
Adapted from the opening chapter of Doctor Who and the Daleks by David Whittaker.
I'm Barbara. Barbara Wright. Susan. Susan's in the road.
A meeting on the Common.
Oh my goodness.
I say, you there! Are you trying to get us all killed? There's petrol everywhere!
Featuring Stephen Noonan.
What are you doing here?
As the First Doctor. Out now. Order online at warpwarp.co.uk. So, from Big Finish, as you sort of hinted before, you're just giving it up, but like a private eye, one more job.
Yeah, then, exactly what happened, yeah.
Yeah, Russell T. Davis, because of Jubilee, phones you up.
Yeah, phones up.
When did you hear the show was coming back, and how soon after that did you hear that you were going to be writing it?
I heard the show's coming back the same day we all did. I was very excited. I mean, God, it was amazing. You know, I mean, I would, and I'd written my final Big Finish, as I thought, And I thought, what a wonderful treat. I mean, it's coming up for the 40th anniversary. And I, you know, I just thought how joyful it's going to be to sit down and watch new Doctor Who. And people said to me, because I'd done TV, I'd just come off doing my first TV, actually, which was a show called Born and Bred, created by Chris Chibnall. And people said to me, well, you've done TV. I said, yeah, I'm not going to do Doctor. I'm not going to get Doctor Who. I said, there's not a chance. I mean, thank you, because they were saying, oh, you should go for that. I said, I'm not going to go for it. It's not how it's going to work. And no, they're not going to come to me. I'm far too junior a writer.
It's what everyone says is you could be a writer and have lots of credits, but you have to be asked to be on Doctor Who.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was an extraordinary thing, because I'm quite certain that a year later I wouldn't have been asked. I mean, the reason I was asked is because Russell, it was totally right place at the right time. Russell had heard Jubilee and my other Big Finish issues, and he was looking around for writers he thought got it without explanation what Doctor Who was, because of course there hadn't been any. And the BBC at that time seemed still very reluctant to do Doctor Who. You go to those early meetings, it was quite clear that they weren't really sure that this was a good idea or not. And so if Russell had changed his mind and said, let's not, they'd have been quite pleased about that, you know. So I think by series two, when it was a big success, they'd never have wanted to employ a writer as junior as me on it. But at that point, I just sort of snuck in. And because Russell liked the idea of Jubilee, I mean, not to be fair, Jubilee, I think he liked the idea of a lone Dalek. And that was what Jubilee had in it. And incredibly kindly, because, I mean, I told him this at the time, which I probably shouldn't have done, but he could simply have just written and said, oh, can I use that idea? I'd have said, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have fought for it. I wasn't going to ask money for it. It's only an idea. Of course he could have done it. And looking back at it, as well, it seems crazy now to me that he didn't, because he gave me a really pivotal episode. I was bringing back the Daleks. It was the first introduction of what the Time War was. I mean, that's obviously a showrunner's episode. That's what you'd give. You know, Stephen or Chris, and indeed Russell later, would have said, well, that's one of mine. If you're going to commission another writer, you give them the Lazarus Experiment. You give them, you know, I don't know why I said that one in particular, but that's what, you know, but you know what I mean. You don't give them Dalek. You give them the Long Games. But for some reason on that first series, Russell incredibly generously got the four of us in and wanted us to be writing our best takes at doing Doctor Who, as opposed to doing filler episodes. We were being encouraged to do Doctor Who as we felt we thought it should be done. And it was tremendously gracious of him and incredibly, I mean, I can't get over the generosity of it, actually. I mean, even all these years on, because it shouldn't have happened that way, that I was just told I could write Dalek.
I mean,
so I did, you know, I mean, an amazing experience.
A wonderful episode. Yeah, so in the build-up to all that, obviously you knew Chibnall, and I think you knew Paul Cornell, did you, from Born and Bred?
Yeah, I didn't. Yes, that's right. I mean, I knew Paul a bit before. I mean, I'd met Paul at various Doctor Who fan things.
Yeah.
I didn't know Paul very well, because we don't live in the same sort of place, but I was like Paul, and I read his New Adventures. And again, I never quite got on with the New Adventures, because I'd come off an English literature degree, and I like reading 19th century literature and foreign literature mostly, and I was a bit of a snob about reading mm-hmm. Doctor Who books, and I thought, if I was going to read Doctor Who books, I wanted to be a bit more accessible than the ones I was reading. I just thought, if I'm going to be doing this, I want them to be fun, and these are quite hard work. If I want hard work, I'll go back and read Gabriel García Márquez, you know.
Yeah.
So there was a sense, but Paul's novels were, I thought, great. So Paul was there. I didn't know Mark at that point. I did know Stephen a bit. In fact, Stephen was the one who encouraged me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because stupidly, I was nervous of the idea of doing Doctor Who. I just didn't know what I should do, you know, because I knew I wasn't a very experienced TV writer. I knew it was going to be quite difficult. And I said to Stephen, are you going to do it? And he said, well, of course. And I said, you think I should? He said, why would you not do that? And I said, well, I don't know. I just thought, I said to him, is it a good career move?
Could you imagine sitting here 20 years later going, oh, I could have written for the first season of Doctor Who, but I decided
absolutely. And
I decided not to. Actually, what?
I mean, They were pivotal moments. I mean, I remember when we lost the diary and I went to Russell's house in Manchester to discuss what I should do next, because, you know, they wanted another script, but we couldn't use the Daleks, and I wasn't sure how, you know, quite what I should do with it. And I had ideas, but they were too far removed from what they wanted. And Russell said to me at that point, he said, looking back, he's probably quite angry because I was a bit high maintenance. And then I remember him saying to me, look, if you don't want to be doing it, you know, I could take it over and maybe we'll bring you back some other day. And I could have just said, yeah, it's just too much hard work, because I was finding it quite hard. And the idea that now I'd be looking back and saying, yeah, I could have done Doctor Who. I mean, it'd be the most awful thing. I shall tell you very quickly, because it's an interesting... When I was 11 years old, my French teacher at school came back from a party once and told me, I've just met this Doctor Who writer. And I said, oh, wow. And she gave me a name, and I said, he's not written Doctor Who. She said, oh, yeah, no, he has. I said, but I know all Doctor Who writers. And she said, well, now you know another one, which I knew at the time wasn't a logical thing. I said to her, but there's a finite number of them, and you can't just add another one. And she got a bit cross with me, and I pulled out of the fire by saying, well, maybe I could interview him for my fanzine. And she went away and came back to me a week later and said, oh, no, he doesn't want to be interviewed. Actually, there was a really bad situation with Doctor Who. And it was Lewis Greifel, who wrote Pyramids of Mars originally, as it turns out. And, you know, poor guy going to a party and the inevitable question, oh, you're a writer, what have you ever written? And he tells a story about how he had a Doctor Who connection. It doesn't reach the air, but he's not going to say that because you don't, because what does it matter? And even then he gets called, you know, the days before the internet, even then he gets called up by some annoying kid at a school saying, you didn't write Pyramids of Mars. I mean, I never interviewed him, but that's the situation I'd have been in, you know, forever going to parties and saying, well, I worked on Doctor Who once. And I'd say, oh yes, which one did you write? And I'd say, well, it didn't actually reach the air. And it would be awful. And that's so humiliating. And it was so close. I mean, you know, it could easily have happened. The worst part of Doctor Who for me actually was spending all that time on it, assuming I was going to be sacked. Because I knew Doctor Who history. I knew that happens all the time. And I thought, it's going to happen to me because I don't know what I'm doing.
If
I could go back in time, I'd tell myself to calm down and stop being such
a... I know, it's all the horrible part of this business, isn't it? Was it like best part of 2 years, sort of writing?
I was commissioned, because you didn't ask this, actually. I got the call late 2003, so a few weeks after the announcement. And I suppose I delivered it. I suppose they began filming late summer 2004. So it wasn't as long as it seemed. It was probably about 9 months.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah.
And it's not, you know, and people tell me these things now at conventions. They say, oh, and you did that 15 drafts. And I said, yeah, probably, but so did we all. I mean, that is the job.
Yeah, yeah. Only writers would go, 15 people who aren't writers would...
Yeah, and of course, most of the drafts aren't that different. I mean, get to a certain stage and you're just sort of cutting its toenails again. And there aren't that many major drafts you do. I mean, in fact, that part of it was actually the fun part. I think the part where I think because my background isn't TV, I began to get tired of it around the time that it was just another set of minimal drafts. I genuinely would love going to meetings where I'd sit with Russell. I mean, I know it sounds silly, but it was so inspiring. And he's so good. And he'd tell you why your script was awful. And then he'd say, do it again. But here was some, maybe we should try this and this. And you'd think, oh, that's a good idea. And then you'd go away and you'd do a completely new take on it. And that was, and it was inspiring. And I loved that sort of part of it. I found it, I think I was too inexperienced to understand the process where you just have to keep the plate spinning, to use that analogy again, for months and months and months, and just do little rewrites and just do things where you suddenly have to make minor changes because of the location or because the director asks for something or the actors want something. And that sort of stuff, I found that tiring. I sort of wanted to move on to a different project at that point. But yeah, I mean, it was a remarkable time, though. I mean, and I'm so proud I got to be on that first series.
As I think I've said to you when we met at Capital, it was the episode that sort of changed a lot of it's because Russell, as I think you've said, Russell knew how to structure that first series.
Oh yeah,
The expert he is, and your episode, The Return of the Daleks, being serious and coming after we'd had some silliness and the introduction.
Yeah, which of
and
course
it was perfect. But that was the day Doctor Who came back.
I remember saying to you, everybody talking about it. I think I said it to you at Capitol, but you know, people come up to you, which is very funny, and they'll thank you for it as if you were doing it without Russell's knowledge. This was so funny. Don't you say things like, "Oh, I didn't like that sort of thing," but thank God you came on and turned it around. And I say, "Yeah, Russell was really surprised when that went out because he'd
of done course a Dalek. Time. Why didn't I think of that?"
Yeah, and of course it's all part of Russell. I mean, Russell was, I think, rather cleverly. You know, we didn't know we'd get a second series. He was wanting to try all sorts of different styles out and see which ones worked. The irony was that almost all of them worked. The audience seemed to like all of it. You know, Aliens of London was an attempt to try and pull it in one direction to see whether or not the series would work that way or whether it would break and snap. And it's as far as it ever goes down there because Sarah Jane takes over that sort of style. But, you know, I mean, Dalek was a deliberate attempt to sort of then pull it the other direction to see what would happen there. And either one of them could have been wrong. I mean, Dalek could have just been horrendously badly received because it's a really dark story. But again, all those instincts I had for making it quite funny were understandably draft after draft flattened because that isn't what they wanted. So actually, it was very, very grim. I mean, I remember my discussions about it being, I mean, I really disliked the fact that at the end, the Doctor picks up a gun and Russell would say, "Why?" And I'd say, "Well, can't it just be an engine? How about he finds an engine part and he modifies it?" He said, "Well, it's still a gun. I mean, you know, you're just hiding from the fact that this is actually what the Doctor has become." And he was right. I mean, I was still, even though I really enjoyed writing this darker version of the Doctor, a part of me was still shying away from the implications of it. And it was, you know, it was Russell who kept encouraging me to go further, and quite rightly so. I mean, he was, I think he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, he's not bad, is he? He's
he's all right.
Yeah.
He's good. Yeah.
Yeah. So early on, were you at the sort of near legendary curry house meal with Paul and
Steve, the Chula.
Where the Chula warship comes from. And
I was, and we took a sort of bit of a bet about who could get the word into their script. And of course, Stephen was even
a war. Yeah. I mean, was that a sort of unofficial sort of writer's room meeting?
No. Or... I mean, we weren't kept apart. I mean, which is a typical BBC thing. When I did Born and Bred with Chris, as I say, I didn't know they were writers at all, and we were not encouraged to be with them. But on Doctor Who, we only knew each other. I mean, I met up with Mark quite a bit when he was doing Unquiet Dead, because we were the first two stables.
Out of the gate.
So yeah, we were first out of the gate. So we'd meet up and we would discuss the frustrations, you know, and the excitement. Stephen and I would meet. In fact, Stephen came to the series rather late because he was doing the final series of Coupling first. So, but yeah, we were all very, very mutually supportive. I mean, that day when I found out I wasn't doing it with Daleks, I was actually having a drink with Stephen at the time, and I immediately texted Paul Cornell, who mocked me for the fact that I was using very, very long words. in my horror and grief, I was, you know, being quite pompous, and he thought that was quite funny. We were all friends, and so we were very unofficially, I think we only met up together for once. Paul lived off in Oxfordshire or somewhere, so he wasn't around so much. And we were quite busy, but we were, you know, I think we were all very happy that we were all doing it at the same time. So that was a nice curry evening.
Yeah.
And then the excitement of all meeting up again, I think the next time we all met up was probably, and it's on the DVD extras, where we all go to the first read-through for Rose and Aliens of London. I think that's the next time that we all met together.
Wow.
Properly. And that was fun.
Good. You must have just been pinching yourself throughout.
Well, actually, I was quite miserable that day. You can see it on this because that is the time when I haven't got Dalek and I don't know what I'm doing next. And I think I'm about to be sacked. So Mark is filming everybody having a great time and I'm just sitting there. I could be off the show in a week. I mean, this is awful. I mean, this is wonderful, but hanging by a thread.
There's a parallel universe where you exist on those DVD extras.
Yeah, people are saying, what on earth's that guy who wrote that Big Finish audio doing there? Yeah,
exactly. Well, thank God you live in this timeline.
Oh, dear. No. Well, this really isn't good enough. Suffering satellites, I've travelled across time and space to face you. And now that I'm here, nothing. Aren't you even going to threaten to exterminate me, you know, with your ray gun sticks? Come along. Can't you poke your eye stalks out of issue 6 of Warp Warp? That's issue 6 of Warp Warp, the acclaimed Doctor Who fanzine, to present me with a bit of daring do? Some excitement, for pity's sake? I guess I can't blame them. I mean, it does celebrate 60 years of an unearthly child with a new interview with Carol Ann Ford, graphic reconstructions of the sets from Doctor Who's very first story, an extensive interview with Mark Gatiss about an adventure in space and time, plus Clive Doig, Brian Hodgson, comic strips, and oh, so much more. Heaven knows how they fit it all in. Do you know, I might take a look myself. Oh, yes. Yes, most exciting. All this plus a free disc containing, among other treats, a dynamic 18-minute animation of the much-loved alternative opening to Doctor Who, as told to David Whittaker in his classic 1964 novelization, Doctor Who in an Exciting Adventure with the Daleks. Oh, I'm sorry. You see, we're all now too engrossed in this super new issue. There'll be no excitements from me or these Tin Terrors today. No deadly exterminations. Well, you know what they say. All warp and no slay. Purchase your copy from warpwarp.co.uk now.
So, talking of your buddy Stephen Moffat,
yes,
your final choice, rather, yeah.
Yeah.
I did this the other day. Is the Empty Child / the Doctor Dancers, which is, I would agree, it'd probably be on my list because it's just wonderful.
There are so many reasons. I mean, partly because it also, you can probably tell, I choose things which represent for me happy memories, and I wouldn't want to choose Dalek. But I do think The Empty Child represents for me being on that first series. The night that Dalek went out, we had a party here at the house and the lighters all came and Stephen brought with him a disc of The Empty Child, which he was uncertain. It wasn't quite finished. He wasn't sure we would like it. He was a bit nervous of showing it to us. We got to telling him, put it on. And he did, and he was a bit reluctant, and we watched it, just that first episode, and it was so good. And I remember sitting there thinking, mine's just gone on, and that was really good, my one, but this is better. And I wasn't sulky, I just think, well, the best I can hope for now is I've got 3 weeks to really enjoy being king of Doctor Who, you know. and yet Father's Day's around the corner, and I think that one's great too. So I thought, I've got maybe two. People may not like the long game, I thought, which is true. But I did think, And then that night, and Janie, my wife, was acting at the time and doing a show in the West End, and she came back and she caught The Empty Child. She was in time to watch that. And that night, as we let them all out, she said to me, "Oh, Doctor Who was good tonight." And I said, "Thanks." She said, "No, I didn't mean your one. I meant the one with the gas masks." And I just thought, yeah. And from this point on, actually, it was weird. I mean, I'd finished doing Doctor Who pretty much, and I knew that really. But I also just thought, seeing Empty Child made me realise, oh, that's what I should have been doing. I mean, that for me is such a great template. It felt so modern in its storytelling. It was so funny. It was so scary. It was full of so many clever tricks of your expectations of what the story was going to be. I mean, it's such a... And it was all because I've been at the first read-through for it, which had gone really badly. It was one of the worst read-throughs I've ever been to for anything. It was near Christmas, and most of the actors weren't there, and the ones who were there were in quite a bad mood. Chris and Billy and... just wasn't, you know, people just were tired. And you had non-actors reading in other parts really badly. I mean, yeah, I remember...
That's death one of the editors, when that happens.
Well, it was one of the editors reading, "Are you my mummy? Are you my mummy?" And you think, all right. And at the end of it, Stephen was called out to have a chat with one of the execs, I think. Not Russell, probably Mal Young.
Mm.
He was told, you know, this isn't really working. And Stephen said, "I think it is. I'm leaving it as it is." It's that sort of knowledge, which is that awful thing that I realised that in that moment, had I written The Empty Child, had I written that exact same script, I would have had to have changed it. Stephen had the strength and also the extra authority at that stage of his career to say, "Nope, I think that's good." He was being encouraged to put in a, you know, put in a monster. He was, even at that late stage, it was suddenly being seen as like, this is not going to work.
Mm.
And it's an indication to me actually about how important it is to stick to your guns when you believe in a project. Because Empty Child, as I say, written by anybody else, that those exact same words would not have been made like that.
Yeah.
It was at that stage only because Stephen said no. And it's so good. It's such a good story. And had that been the only one that Stephen had ever written, you know that that would have made him out to have still been one of Doctor Who's greats. The fact that he then, for the next few years for Russell, every year got to have the park with another one, and then took on the show and ran it for six seasons. Doing such extraordinary stuff. And being so inventive throughout. You know, not everything maybe being what we all expected or wanted all the time, but just keep being so ambitious. I mean, it's a remarkable achievement. And actually to have sort of been there for his first episode.
On this little podcast, it's second only to Dalek in people's choice. Yeah, people choose Dalek a lot, and they also choose Empty Child a lot.
I have to be honest. I think if you're in a bunker anyway, you probably want to watch a story set in a bunker, which is what Dalek is. I think you get very tired of saying, "Oh, I want to have a bit of, you know." I mean, okay, there's not much sunlight in the show because it's usually set at night time, but you want a bit of fresh air out there. But also, I do think that Empty Child has so much depth to it.
Mm.
And Dalek hasn't got... I am very proud of Dalek, but it's not about variety of tone. Empty Child has so much going. It's so moving as well. You know, the sophistication of actually how much Stephen is changing your emotional response to what's happening is really, really smart. And I think you could, if you were in a bunker forced to only watch one Doctor Who story forever, over and over again, I think you would be less bored of The Empty Child. I think it'd take a while to get bored of that one. It's another example of Russell's generosity. Yeah. You know, it's Russell also saying to Stephen, go out and do. Which I think, looking back, was what he was encouraging anyway. I mean, I think we were all, you know, understandably, we were quite tentative at times, you know.
Mm.
When someone says to you, write Doctor Who, and particularly when it's the new series, you're not quite sure what that even is.
Mm.
And you want it to be this big hit. And you have this fear that you're going to be the ones who do the equivalent of the TV movie.
Mm.
And you're going to be remembered as being the people who had the chance of, and you drop the ball and it's now never going to come back again. Of all of us, I mean, you know, Mark playing with his Hinchcliffe stuff and then being encouraged to be, you know, which he seized on and pulled to. We were all trying to find our way through. Stephen just comes along, admittedly after we've done our first few drafts. So I think he'd seen what we were doing. And he'd seen actually how we were progressing. And I think he took those first few drafts we'd been doing and said, "Well, okay, it's going to be that sort of direction. I can run with this." And I think he really does run with it. I think that what you get with Empty Child is something so... It's so confident. It's such an amazing script. And I remember first reading it, because, you know, Stephen sent me an early draft, and I thought, I'm not sure you could do that. I remember thinking that just in terms of the way that the banter worked. I just thought, I'm not sure. You know, all that flirting with Captain Jack and Rose. I'm not sure. Wasn't used to it because I was a Doctor Who fan.
And Star Trek references annoyed some. That's a bit Spock. Annoyed some really fusty old fans at the time. I remember.
I didn't mind that. So
no, I didn't mind. No, yeah. I didn't. I think it's a work of genius. But I remember some fusty old fans, first generation fans, really not liking the banter and the flirting. But
I was just thrown by it. I mean, I was asked to direct to establish a sort of flirty relationship between Rose and Adam.
Mm-hmm.
I never got it right because I just couldn't understand why Rose would care about Adam because she's got the doctor, and that's what I thought the main thing was. Mm-hmm. But I think actually looking back, they were hoping of something of that sort of easy, bantery, witty relationship. But I just couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I could now, but I understand what it was that was being asked of me. But at the time, that wasn't Doctor Who. So yeah. Adam, for me, ends up being like an Adric figure. Whereas Stephen, given that chance to do it, you know, this sort of other companion role, does somebody who spins off and creates his own TV series. Captain Clark is so charismatic. And, you know, John Barron, bless his heart, is a major part of that as well. You know, John has such charisma. But nevertheless, you know, that does all come, I think, in part because Stephen creates a relationship comedy in Empty Child, which is incredibly watchable and so entertaining to watch.
Out now from Cutaway Comics, part 2 of the Gods and Monsters saga.
And so I am banished.
Sutek.
Robbed of physical form. Set adrift in the black void between galaxies. Not for the first time. For I am Sutek, destroyer, sworn enemy of all creation. And creation has many defenders. But this defeat feels different. Something new gnaws at what remains of my diminished soul. Not merely defeat, but something I dare not even name.
Sutek. Sutek. Sutek, hear me.
Nephthys.
Yes, O brother husband. Let my voice guide you back to me and home to Neticatet.
The land of the dead. And yet, for me, it means life, a reprieve, and for the first time in millennia, a body.
In this place, you will always have form, or the appearance of form. But this you know, I have been granted permission to save you, but not restore you.
You always were weak, sister wife. Sentimental. The others would have let me die.
And they would have been justified in doing so. You were brought into this universe to bring chaos and suffering and death, but as part of the greater whole, you played a role in the balance of all things. And then, brother, husband, you forgot your place.
I declared war on all life.
You went insane. Even I, my love, wished death upon you. Only now,
you need my insanity.
Yes.
Who do you want me to kill?
An animated version of this trailer, starring Gabriel Wolf as Sutek and Zoe Iqbal as Nephthys, is one of the features on the VAM disc that comes free with the comic, only when you purchase direct from us at cutawaycomics.co.uk. I mean, the whole of that season is amazing. A little miracle.
It is good, isn't it? It is. I mean, I think if we had crashed and burned, I remember Russell saying this to us early on. He said that we can't predict what's going to happen. But he said, if it does end up being that this ends up that in 10, 20 years' time, we're watching old DVDs of this alone in our house at 11 at night, remembering. Let's make it show that we are proud of. Let's at least not feel that we fudged it. So there was a real commitment to it. I mean, it was funny being on that side of the fence. It was funny watching the expectations for fans on the line, knowing what it was that we were trying to do, knowing that their hopes was going to be a bit Star Wars. It wasn't going to be like that. It was going to be our thing. It was going to be as crazy as it was going to be. People suddenly hearing rumours about farting aliens and refusing to believe it. And I thought, no, it's true. It's all there.
Yeah.
Because that's Russell's thing. I mean, over the years following, I would hear from, on the grapevine for people involved, stuff that I said to me, he's making Catherine Tate a companion. And I said, he's not, is he? Why is he doing that?
Yeah.
Every single time, that I sort of shy away from something that I think sounds crazy, it's always amazing.
Yeah, I've been like that every turn. I was like, Billy Piper? No.
Yeah. I remember, I still didn't trust him when
Yeah, when it's Captain Tate, really? I still didn't trust that he knew what he was doing.
I remember writing to Russell saying, there were these rumours that it's going to be Billy Piper. Russell said, oh, just imagine. And, and then, of course, it was. I mean, I think that was long before. It wasn't. Mm. It was people just suggesting names. But the idea of... I remember it's just an awful thing to confess. I hope that your listeners will understand this is against me. But I remember having this, I'd done about 4 or 5 drafts of Dark before Billy was cast. And I thought, oh, they've cast a pop singer. That's not how I imagined Rose. Because I had this idealized... I probably imagined a Sarah Jane Smith, because that's what you do, is you idealize a companion. And I loved this slate. I wrote her a love letter when I was a teenager. I mean, I asked her to run away with me and leave Brian Miller. I actually did do that. I put in brackets the actor, Doug Dell from Snake Dance. I actually had to explain to her in her love letter who her husband was, because that's the sort of fact I was. When they cast Billy, I remember going to that first read-through thinking that, what if she were just awful? What if she just sat there and said, hello, my name is Rose? I just dreadful, patronising. And I sat there and I thought, oh, she's amazing. She's actually amazing. And it became suddenly clear that she was going to be this tremendous success. And, of course, that was one of the joys of it, was that we had everybody from the BBC there in Wales. And in my memory, that's because they were celebrating it. But they weren't. It was a really tense day. It was the BBC en masse, all the heads, coming on to see if this was any good or not. Because they were deciding whether or not they were going to back it, and they came away from that read-through buzzing. And that's when suddenly the BBC now committed to Doctor Who being a massive success. And it was that afternoon in Cardiff. It was Billy. It was Chris and Billy, but in part also. But we knew Chris was going to be good. It was seeing how good Billy was, which I think guarantees the longevity of the show now. Because I think if we hadn't, if Russell and Andy Pryor, if they hadn't got Rose right, I don't think we'd have a show which survived the first year or two. I just don't think that would happen. I think that, I know fans can be a little bit fed up with Rose now because, the relationship is something which can, seem almost too important, and people therefore find it irritating. But I think it's such an important thing just to get the show into the success it became, especially once Chris left. You know, Billy's the person there for him, carries the show going forward. Amazing. And Billy, yeah, and as you say, when they cast her, I had a similar reaction to you, and I was on the show. I just thought, I'm so wrong. So, I all my instincts are always wrong about everything. Always. Yeah. So, which is one of the reasons why I should have never put in any position of power on anything. People very sweetly occasionally, because they don't understand really what the job entails. So, wouldn't it be nice if you were showrunner? Doctor Who would be cancelled within one day. It would take one day. I'd burn it to the ground without meaning to. It'd be so awful. It'd be like if I were in the cockpit of an aeroplane and they say, oh, just hold the wheel for a minute. I would crash the plane into the ground in seconds before it was even possible to do so. Everybody would leave en masse. people, they would go back to the archives. I would be so bad that they would go to the archives and they would, everything that was newly discovered, they would set fire to again. And then they would destroy the animations and then they'd destroy all the series and it would be taken off BritBox and it would be the end. Everything would be over. And fans would be pleased. Fans would be pleased at the moment because they also would now hate the show so much that they'd be glad it was gone.
Somebody let Rob Sherman be showrunner.
Yeah. I mean, he broke it so fast. That is what we would say. Yeah.
You'd be the Liz Truss of Doctor Who.
Oh, God, yeah. And then a year later, I would turn up a Doctor Who convention and explain how I was actually the saviour and everybody else got it wrong. So I would have no contrition and no sense of anything except my own insanity. I don't turn this into a political thing.
No.
I'm politically very unhappy these days.
Yes. I think you are not alone. But anyway, it has been lovely talking about Snake
Thank
Dance.
Thank you very much.
And
yes.
Big Finish and Horror Fang Rock and cozy non-political
and
things.
Humphreys. Yes, and
yeah. Yes.
Well, Doctor Who is always going to be a happy place.
Yeah.
Even when I don't like Doctor Who very much, I always love it. I mean, that's part of the joy. I don't like every single story.
No.
But I do love every single story because every Doctor Who is great because it's Doctor Who.
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah. Anyway, Rob, I will let you go, and it's been an absolute joy, and I will.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton, produced by James Steventon of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.